And here we go with the reading of today's Wall Street Journal. Pardon me. Today is Thursday, the 18th of December, 2025, and with today's Wall Street Journal, we say hello to Ken.
Hello and welcome. In Wednesday's markets, AI-themed stocks drop further, sending NASDAQ index lower. Tech stocks slid, continuing to drag down major indexes as investors worried about the future of AI-themed stocks. The NASDAQ Composite Index dropped 1.8%, while the S&P 500 slipped 1.2%, the biggest falls for each benchmark in nearly a month. Tech giants Google parent Alphabet, NVIDIA, and Tesla all fell more than 3%, leading the Magnificent Seven growth stocks lower, while the Dow Industrials fell 0.5%, dragged lower by a fall in Caterpillar shares. As the year comes to a close, investors are growing uneasy about the circular nature of artificial intelligence, particularly after Oracle set out to build new data center complexes across the country to fulfill its deal to provide $300 billion worth of computing services to OpenAI. Oracle shares fell 5.4% Wednesday after a Financial Times report raised concerns about funding talks on the data center the company is planning. Oracle has now fallen 12% in December, and chip company Broadcom has lost 19%. Given the excitement that has permeated over the prior few months regarding the data center build-out and the whole AI complex, anything that hints that there's a slowdown afoot is going to make people nervous, said Doug Cohen, senior portfolio manager at Fiduciary Trust International. Tech shares have struggled in recent weeks after a strong rally as investors stress-tested their belief that AI and data center investments will yield growing profits across markets. Even with recent declines, the S&P is up 14% for the year, and the NASDAQ has advanced 18%. Jim Thorne, chief market strategist at Wellington Altrus, said that at this time of year, long-term investors tend to be hands-off, while more speculative traders fuel ups and downs in the market. It's a sentiment-driven market. You get these extremes that are highly emotional, he said. Market strategists say there is still a lot to watch for as investors come out of a period of data blindness from the government shutdown. The Federal Reserve had forecast one rate cut for 2026, but many in the market expect there to be more. Fed Governor Christopher Waller, a candidate to lead the central bank, spoke in favor of further cuts before his interview with President Trump, citing the slowing job market. After this week's jobs data revealed an uptick in the unemployment rate, investors are looking to tomorrow's consumer price data and weekly jobless claims report for a better idea of the state of the U.S. labor market. Chevron, a major shipper of Venezuelan oil to the U.S., rose 1.9% after President Trump ordered a blockade of sanctioned tankers entering and exiting the country. United Parcel Service shares rose 0.8% after the U.S. Postal Service said it is reopening access to its last-mile delivery network. Oil prices climb as Venezuela blockade raises supply risks. Oil prices rose more than 1.5% on Wednesday after President Trump ordered a total blockade of all sanctioned tankers entering and leaving Venezuela, raising risks of prolonged supply disruptions in the region. In European trade, Brent crude was up 1.3% to $59.68 a barrel after briefly rising above $60, while West Texas Intermediate gained 1.2% to $55.94 a barrel. European energy stocks also climbed. The move marks a significant escalation in U.S. pressure on Venezuela and follows the recent seizure of a tanker, raising the risk that prolonged disruptions could affect exports of roughly 590,000 barrels per day, most of which are destined for China, said Soo Jin Kim, analyst at Japan's MUFG. Trump said in a post on Truth Social on Tuesday that the U.S. military presence would only get bigger unless Maduro's regime returns oil, land, and other assets that they previously stole from us, an apparent reference to Venezuela's nationalization of U.S.-linked holdings in the country. The announcement comes days after the U.S. seized a sanctioned tanker allegedly carrying Venezuelan crude to the black market, with the White House indicating there would be more ship seizures. The threat has left tankers stuck off the coast of Venezuela. In the previous trading session, crude benchmarks settled at their lowest since February 2021, pressured by prospects of a widening surplus and renewed optimism over Russia-Ukraine peace talks. Prices have fallen more than 20% this year. Progress in talks to end the war in Ukraine has also weighed on prices, as a potential deal could lead to the easing or lifting of U.S. sanctions on Russian oil companies, adding barrels to an already well-supplied market. While Russian seaborne oil exports have held up since the Trump administration imposed sanctions on Rosneft and Lukoil, much of that crude has struggled to find buyers, leaving a growing volume of Russian oil at sea. And a couple of articles from the Herd on the Street page. Oracle stock hangs on a squishy number. AI investors are scrutinizing a once obscure metric related to future sales. Signing a 12-figure contract with a customer is one thing. Collecting is a whole other matter. A once-obscure footnote disclosure called Remaining Performance Obligations, or RPOs, has become one of the most closely watched numbers for investors in AI-themed stocks, especially Oracle. It is also a lot squishier than investors may realize, helping to explain the recent sharp fall in Oracle's stock. RPOs, which have a standard definition across companies, represent contracted sales that have yet to be recognized as revenue. In other words, management believes the sales are probable, not definite. Because of that, RPOs aren't on the face of a company's financial statements. Still, analysts use the number to help shape their future estimates of the company's business. If they start to doubt the future sales are indeed probable, they are likely to take a dimmer view of a company's outlook. Oracle stock soared in early September, at one point jumping 36% in a single day, after a bombshell earnings report in which it said its RPOs had more than tripled since the previous quarter to $455 billion. Since then, Oracle's RPOs have jumped to $523 billion as of November 30th, or about nine times Oracle's revenue for the past four quarters. Yet the stock has cratered, down more than 40% from its record on September 10th. Investors have grown uneasy about the circular nature of many of the AI sector's dealings and are looking askance at huge gains in RPOs. They are particularly wary about OpenAI's ability to meet gargantuan future commitments. It is widely known that about $300 billion of the increase in RPOs at Oracle was due to a five-year contract with OpenAI to supply computing capacity, although Oracle hasn't expressly disclosed this. To meet the demand, Oracle is building new, colossal data center complexes across the country. The $300 billion portion from OpenAI has drawn skepticism from investors and even some Wall Street analysts. J.P. Morgan credit analyst Erica Speer titled her December 15th note on Oracle, "If you build it, will they pay?" D.A. Davidson analyst Gil Lauria, in a December 12th note, said, "Since OpenAI is unlikely to deliver on its $300 billion commitment, we believe the best course of action for Oracle would be to restructure that contract proactively in order to deploy capital more responsibly instead of pretending that it has $523 billion of RPO." OpenAI is closely held and doesn't disclose its financial reports. It has about $1.4 trillion of commitments over the next 8 years, according to a December 5th report by Moody's. But it has comparatively little revenue, and it is still in the fundraising stage. OpenAI has said it is on pace to top $20 billion of annualized revenue by the end of this year. Equity investors, including SoftBank, which has agreed to invest $30 billion. Uncertainty about NVIDIA's plans with OpenAI and the possible impacts on Oracle exemplifies the circularity that characterizes much of the AI sector. Oracle is a major customer of NVIDIA, which someday might be investing in OpenAI, which recently signed a big contract with Oracle. The pact between OpenAI and NVIDIA has taken longer than initially expected. The companies on September 22nd announced a letter of intent for a deal in which NVIDIA would invest as much as $100 billion in OpenAI over many years, and OpenAI would buy millions of NVIDIA's specialized chips for its AI infrastructure. At the time, NVIDIA and OpenAI said they expected to finalize the details in the coming weeks, but that was almost 3 months ago. In its latest quarterly report, NVIDIA said there is no assurance that any investment will be completed on expected terms, if at all. If NVIDIA backs away from OpenAI, maybe another investor would step up to fill the gap, but maybe not. Or if it turns out OpenAI can't pay Oracle the full $300 billion, maybe Oracle could land another gigantic customer to fill its place. Suffice it to say, if NVIDIA's investment in OpenAI falls through, it likely would be bad news for Oracle stock. It might be far from certain that OpenAI will be able to pay Oracle the $300 billion, but the relevant question is how far. That is the difference between recognizing the contracted amounts as RPOs or not. Whether companies are allowed to record RPOs comes down, in part, to a simple question that might not have an easy answer. Is collectability probable under the accounting rules? This is a subjective determination. It is possible different people looking at the same facts could reasonably reach different conclusions. It is also possible for management's conclusions to change as facts change. What looks probable today might not look that way a year from now. The accounting rules don't define probable in percentage terms, but it is a higher bar than more likely than not. In practice, some accountants peg the threshold at 70% or higher. The numbers behind the artificial intelligence boom are mind-bogglingly large. Whether they are real is a judgment call. Excuse me. Buy the dip? No, just buy and hold. Scooping up stocks during a scary sell-off has become routine enough to get its own acronym, BTFD. If you time it right, buying the effing dip sure sounds obscenely profitable. Like Matt Damon said in that crypto ad, fortune favors the brave. Does it, though? Quantitative investing firm AQR Capital Management ran the numbers and says it produces worse returns both before and after adjusting for risk than just staying invested. In a study published this month, it writes, "You cannot just say if prices will one day be higher, then I should buy the dip," as the belief that prices will eventually go up was also true before, during, and after the dip. AQR is in the business of profiting from investing factors that have earned extra returns over time and are likely to in the future. Two of the best-known ones have been trend following and value. Stocks tend to continue their direction over shorter periods, but then eventually reverse if they become too cheap or pricey. Buying dips can make those trades at the wrong times, though. A stock or sector that suddenly got cheaper doesn't automatically become a good opportunity. There are exceptions, of course. The unusually short, sharp COVID-19 bear market of 2020 is one. It was the quickest descent into an S&P 500 bear market in history from a record, and also the fastest recovery to a fresh high. Dip buyers made out like bandits, wowing many younger investors. Millions were inspired to open their first brokerage accounts in 2020 and 2021. But the next year, it turned into a bad strategy during the longer bear market. AQR notes that Google searches for buy the dip fizzled as 2022 dragged on. Then it worked again around this year's Liberation Day plunge when stocks roared back a week later. One reason buying dips alone can't beat buying and holding is because investors who keep dry powder aren't fully invested for long enough. But what about as a separate strategy with part of your money to smooth out bumps? Some investors keep a portion of their portfolios in trend-following funds for that reason. AQR ran the numbers on how the two methods compare as market hedges. Over four major S&P 500 bear markets of the past quarter century, a basket of trend-following funds averaged a return of 28.6%, while various dip-buying methods lost 18.4% on average. Fortune favors the lazy doesn't have quite the zing, but just buying index funds probably will turn out better in the end. Adderall distributor is indicted. Telehealth company Doane still operates and has served tens of thousands. The Justice Department indicted Adderall startup Doane Global late Tuesday, a month after its founder and top doctor were both convicted of a conspiracy to distribute the controlled substances. The indictment alleges that Doane and a sister company, Mindful Mental Wellness, provided easy access to stimulants such as Adderall without a legitimate medical purpose and conspired to defraud insurers and obstruct justice. The indictment alleges that Mindful served as a reskin of Doane in order to circumvent pharmacies that had blocked prescriptions by Doane-affiliated clinicians. The companies are still operating and have served tens of thousands of patients. If convicted, the companies could continue operating but would likely have to do so under court supervision. They also likely would face fines and a requirement to improve compliance. Doane Global used lies and deceit to carry out a sophisticated and wide-ranging telehealth fraud scheme, obtaining over $100 million in the process, said Acting Assistant Attorney General Matthew R. Gilardi of the Justice Department's Criminal Division. The company was the subject of a series of articles in the Wall Street Journal from 2022 to 2024, describing how some Doane clinicians felt pressured to prescribe Adderall, while others wrote prescriptions much faster than is typical for clinicians doing thorough patient evaluations. Doane and Mindful didn't respond to requests for comment. The company previously has said it is a technology platform that connects patients with medical professionals and doesn't prescribe medications. It also has defended its prescription practices and said providers use their clinical judgment to decide whether to prescribe stimulants to patients. Doane's founder, Ruthia He, a former Facebook product designer with no medical background, was convicted on seven criminal counts in November. Doane's top doctor, David Brody, was convicted on six criminal counts. The two are scheduled to be sentenced in February, and each could serve years in prison. Two other Doane executives and six of its clinicians previously pleaded guilty to a conspiracy count and cooperated with the government's investigation. While clinicians are based in the U.S., the founder, He, had moved most other operations to China prior to her own indictment. When she was arrested, a U.S. employee posted a warning to customers on the company's Instagram account. Under police light emojis, the message said, "The management team from China has taken over operations. It was signed the U.S. Core Team. The post was removed within minutes. The company's early investors included Kraft Ventures, the firm co-founded by Trump administration AI and crypto czar David Sacks. The art market stages comeback. A $31.4 million bar cart shaped like a hippopotamus, a $30.2 million Fabergé egg, a $12 million solid gold Morazio Catalan toilet, and that $236.4 million Gustave Clement portrait. After a two-year slump, sales surged across nearly every category at the world's chief auction houses as younger collectors paid more for luxury goods while seasoned buyers competed for masterpieces from prestigious estates. Sellers tracking the market downturn started slapping lower price tags on their pieces as well, which stoked momentum in the second half of the year. Overall, Sotheby's and Christie's sales topped $13.2 billion in 2025, up from $11.7 billion the year before. Sellers were waiting to see if prices were coming up, and buyers were wondering if prices were going down anymore, said Charles Stewart, Sotheby's chief executive. But all those expectations have tightened, and now everyone feels more confident. Sotheby's said Tuesday its overall sales grew 17% to $7 billion in 2025. About $5.7 billion of that total represented auction sales, up 26% from 2024. Another $1.2 billion represented privately brokered art and luxury sales, down from $1.3 billion from a year ago. Rival Christie's said its sales totaled $6.2 billion over the past year, up 6% from 2024. Its total included $4.7 billion in auction sales, up 8% from the previous year. It also privately sold art and luxury goods totaling $1.5 billion, the same as in 2024. Both houses are privately held and don't report earnings. Neither house neared the last market peak in 2022 when they reported $16.4 billion in sales combined. But collectors are no longer as worried about inflation, war, and broader economic uncertainties, the houses said. Boutique auctioneer Phillips said Tuesday it sold $925 million in art in 2025, up 10% from the year before. Its total included roughly $723 million in auctioned art, plus $202 million in privately brokered sales of art. The upper reaches of the market also survived a crucial testing this fall. For the past 2 years, sales in this $10 million-plus trophy art category fell to $1.2 billion in 2024 from $3.9 billion in 2022, across Sotheby's and Christie's, according to auction tracking firm Art Tactic. This past year, the same segment rose 19.4% to $1.5 billion. Oscars will move to YouTube in 2029. And the Oscars are going to YouTube. The video platform struck a multi-year deal with the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, which will run the Hollywood Awards show from 2029 through 2033, after decades airing on Walt Disney's ABC, YouTube, and the Academy announced Wednesday. ABC will continue to broadcast the Oscars through 2028. YouTube, owned by Alphabet's Google, is the leading video platform in terms of U.S. TV viewing time, according to Nielsen. The Oscars will be available live and for free to more than 2 billion viewers around the world on YouTube and on subscription-based YouTube TV in the U.S., according to a news release. Neil Mohan, YouTube CEO, said in a blog post that partnering with the Academy will inspire a new generation of creativity and film lovers while staying true to the Oscars' storied legacy. An ABC spokesperson said the network looks forward to the next three Oscar telecasts, including for the ceremony's centennial in 2028. Like many award shows, the Oscars have seen their television ratings decline over the years as viewers' behavior shifts to streaming and looking at clips on social media. Recent viewership numbers pale in comparison to the show's peak, when it was watched by more than 55 million people in 1998, the year James Cameron's Titanic dominated the awards ceremony. The show has recently seen an uptick in ratings since hitting an all-time low in 2021 during the COVID-19 pandemic. This year's program, hosted by Conan O'Brien, garnered 19.69 million viewers, up 1% from the previous year, according to Nielsen data. Anora won Best Picture. There have been attempts to tweak the Oscars telecast to improve ratings over the years, including a 2018 proposal to add a category designed to honor popular film, but that idea was scotched after a fierce backlash from Academy members. The upcoming Oscars telecast will include a new casting award, followed by a stunt design category in 2028. Air safety worker bonuses backfired. Bonus payments aim to motivate hard workers and inspire them to go the extra mile. For many air traffic controllers and airport security officers, they are having the opposite effect. After the U.S. government shut down this fall, the Trump administration pledged $10,000 bonuses to hundreds of air traffic controllers, technicians, and Transportation Security Administration officers intended to recognize workers who consistently came in despite working without pay. But only a small number of controllers qualified for the bonuses. Federal agencies said the awards were coming to 311 unionized controllers out of a workforce of about 13,000. 423 unionized technicians out of at least 6,000, and an unspecified number of TSA officers. The American Federation of Government Employees, which represents TSA officers, has sought records detailing the criteria for the bonuses, saying the eligibility requirements weren't clear. The National Air Traffic Controllers Association Labor Union has said it is concerned about the exclusion of thousands of controllers who consistently reported for duty during the shutdown with minimal time off. Recognition should bring the workforce together, not divide it, wrote Nick Daniels, the Air Traffic Controller Union's president, last month in an internal memo reviewed by the Wall Street Journal. The Transportation Department said that the Trump administration has sought to pay controllers quickly after the shutdown and that individuals who went above and beyond were rewarded. The agency said efforts are underway to expand staffing and upgrade technology. Debate over bonus payments for aviation safety workers is part of the broader fallout from the 43-day government shutdown, with federal officials also probing workers' attendance and airlines' compliance with mandated flight restrictions. The federal government is currently funded through the end of January, raising the prospect of another shutdown in the near future. Abby Ingley, a transportation security officer at Tampa International Airport, was one of 122 officers at the airport to receive a $10,000 bonus. Ingley said she had scheduled a couple of days off for day trips during the government shutdown, but canceled them to save money. The 26-year-old said she learned she would receive a bonus December 8th. It makes me happy that I did cancel my leave, said Ingley, who has worked for the agency for 4 years. It gives us a boost of morale internally, and outside it shows recognition to the public. The Department of Homeland Security has announced bonuses airport by airport, including for officers at airports in Houston, Boston, and Tampa, Florida. A TSA spokesman said that bonuses were awarded to officers who went above and beyond their typical duties by delivering excellent service and keeping America's skies safe. The Federal Aviation Administration for years has struggled to fully staff control towers and facilities, often resulting in air traffic controllers working six-day work weeks and 10-hour days. The FAA has said it is working to boost staffing, streamlining its hiring process, and offering cash incentives to recruits. The agency said it has brought in more than 2,000 new controllers in its 2025 fiscal year, ahead of its schedule. President Trump said in a November social media post that he would recommend that air traffic controllers who didn't take time off during the shutdown should each receive a $10,000 bonus. He also threatened to dock the pay of controllers who didn't return to work. Some air traffic controllers had called out of work as the shutdown ground along, leading the FAA to restrict flights. Union officials said that some controllers had grown financially strained and worked other jobs to help pay for childcare and household staples. The bonus payments, perfect attendance requirement for air traffic controllers, which included overtime shifts, has amplified frustrations, according to controllers. Awards have been denied for controllers who missed as much as an hour of work due to fatigue, military leave, or time off that was scheduled as much as a year in advance, they said. They are disappointed, as there were thousands of air traffic controllers that kept the system safe and running during the shutdown, the controllers' union said. When asked in late November about potential awards for controllers who missed a day or two of work during the shutdown, Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy said that he and FAA Administrator Brian Bedford had publicly recognized difficult circumstances faced by all controllers during the shutdown. "We have to look and say, where's the cutoff?" Duffy said at a press event at Newark Liberty International Airport. "If you got 100% on your test, you get a sticker. That's a scratch-and-sniff sticker from the administration." Coinbase joins Kalashi in prediction markets. Coinbase Global is getting into prediction markets in a bid to become a one-stop exchange for Americans' trading needs. The latest sign that tech platforms offering wagers on real-world events are finding their way into every corner of Wall Street. The company has struck a partnership with prediction market specialist Kalashi that will allow Coinbase investors to trade on the outcomes of sports games, elections, and economic indicators using the yes or no bets that have come to define prediction markets. In the months to come, the exchange plans to offer contracts provided by other prediction platforms. Coinbase is expanding outside of crypto to become an everything exchange, much as rival Robinhood Markets has evolved beyond its core stock brokerage business. They and a handful of other firms with roots in either crypto or traditional markets are intent on emerging as the Amazon of consumer financial services. "The Everything Exchange is our vision, where users will be able to trade every asset 24/7 from anywhere in the world on one trusted platform that starts with crypto," said Max Brazenberg, Vice President of Product Management at Coinbase. "We believe that having all of this in one platform will enable more efficiency, more access, and better outcomes for customers." Coinbase is also rolling out AI-powered financial advice and zero-commission stock trading, and expects to introduce tokenized stocks early next year. The company said investors can place prediction bets with U.S. dollars or USDC, the stable coin issued by Circle Internet Group. Coinbase and Robinhood, which also has a partnership with Kalashi, aren't the only financial firms that have sought to embed prediction markets into their offerings. The businesses began to win mainstream acceptance after they correctly called the 2024 presidential election, and a federal court ruling legalized such election bets in the U.S. Kalshi recently raised $1 billion from venture capital firms, including Sequoia and Andreessen Horowitz, at an $11 billion valuation. Meanwhile, Polymarket struck a deal with New York Stock Exchange owner Intercontinental Exchange, which said it would invest up to $2 billion in the crypto-based prediction market, giving it a valuation of roughly $8 billion. The space has also seen a significant influx of major players this year. Gemini, the crypto exchange founded by the Winklevoss twins, recently secured a license from the Commodity Futures Trading Commission to offer prediction markets to U.S. customers. President Trump's media business also said it will introduce prediction markets on his social media platform, Truth Social, through a partnership with the exchange Crypto.com. Flutter Entertainment's FanDuel, a sports betting platform, is also launching a predictions market. CNN, the media network, recently partnered with Kalshi. And Robinhood is pushing further into prediction markets with plans to open a futures and derivatives exchange with market maker Susquehanna International Group to offer additional contracts tied to sports, elections, and other events. Critics argue that prediction markets are a high-risk and lightly regulated form of gambling that is susceptible to insider trading and market manipulation. The financial incentives have sometimes fueled gambling addiction and encouraged users to bet on sensitive or unethical topics. In October, an unknown Polymarket trader earned more than $50,000 in profit by placing a last-minute long-shot bet on a Venezuelan opposition leader's winning the Nobel Peace Prize hours before the Norwegian Nobel Institute's announcement. The wager raised concerns about non-public information being used on prediction markets. Tariq Mansour, Kalshi's co-founder and CEO, said prediction markets are structured in a way that minimizes the conflicts of interest present in gambling. In gambling, there's a house, and the house always wins, and the odds are set by the house, said Mansour. In prediction markets, there's no house. There are no limits on how much people can win. Weyerhaeuser bets on coal shift. Weyerhaeuser, America's largest private landowner, said it launched a venture to turn runty trees and sawdust from its fleet of mills into a replacement for metallurgical coal used in steelmaking. The forest products company said it expects production to begin in 2027 at a facility being built next to its sawmill in Macomb, Mississippi, the first of several biocarbon plants planned by Weyerhaeuser and partner Imium. In its latest effort to find a market for the trees too small or otherwise unsuitable for making lumber, such wood has typically been sent to pulp and paper mills. But U.S. wood pulp consumption capacity plunged due to waning paper demand. This year alone, the U.S. shed roughly 10% of its capacity to produce containerboard, the thick paper used to make corrugated boxes. The closures have walloped timber growers, especially in the South, where landowners ranging from Weyerhaeuser with its vast loblolly plantations to families with 40-acre woodlots raise pine for the forest products industry. Southern pine is planted thick, then thinned after a decade or so to make room for the best specimens to grow into 2x4s and utility poles. Mill closures have left parts of the South bereft of buyers for the culled pulpwood. In some cases, smaller timberland owners have had to pay for thinnings, turning what is typically a payday into a major expense. Looking for homes that fiber has been an important component of our business development efforts, Weyerhaeuser Chief Executive Devin Stockfish said. Weyerhaeuser this summer started building a $500 million facility in Arkansas, where pulpwood prices dropped more than 50% over the past decade, to make engineered lumber from the crooked or stunted trees that would have historically been pulped. Stockfish said he envisions the venture with Imium operating as many as 10 or 11 biocarbon production facilities across Weyerhaeuser's U.S. properties, which include 27 sawmills and panel plants and timberlands that add up to an area bigger than Switzerland. Building permits are being sought for the plant in Mississippi, where pulpwood markets also have been depressed. Imium CEO James Minnell said the company's process works with all species of wood, as well as agricultural residues, grasses, nutshells, cherry pits, and any other, lignocellulosic biomass. The material is heated in the absence of oxygen, driving out elements other than carbon. The result is a drop-in replacement for metallurgical coal. Also known as MET, or coking coal, it is the key to the chemical reactions that produce steel and other metals. It is different from steam coal, which is burned to generate electricity. The U.S. Geological Survey last month added MET coal to its critical minerals list. The designation deems it vital to the economy and national security and opened MET coal to the sort of tariffs that President Trump slapped on steel, aluminum, lumber, and copper products. Imium has been making its products and running trials with metals manufacturers for several years, Minnell said. It has a facility near Marquette, Michigan, that is fed sawdust and treetops from the Upper Peninsula's pineries. It has another completed recently in California and packs with metal producers around the world. Steel producer Steel Dynamics said its own venture with Imium is stepping up production after biocarbon made in September at a plant in Columbus, Mississippi, was used successfully by its flat-rolled steel division. The global race to clean up metals production has revved up demand to replace fossil coal inputs, Minnell said. Emissions rules in Europe and elsewhere favor forest products over fossil fuels because trees remove carbon from the atmosphere as they grow. And from the opinion page, the biggest fraud in welfare. Something is profoundly wrong with the U.S. welfare system, a problem that runs far deeper and is more dangerous than the shocking fraud in Minnesota that has been making headlines. Across the past half century, America has seen what in any other country would be considered a golden age, in which lower-income households have made incredible progress. Despite the end of our post-war economic dominance around 1975, the country's real per capita gross domestic product grew by 142% from 1974 to 2024. More than two-thirds of U.S. households have inflation-adjusted incomes today that would have put them in the top one-fifth of households in 1967. 62% of the children who grew up in the poorest fifth of all households in the 70s and 80s worked their way up to a higher income bracket as adults, some all the way to the top quintile. Yet even as our economy has experienced broad-based growth, real federal welfare spending has soared by 765%. More than twice as fast as total federal spending, and now costs $1.4 trillion annually. Were that money simply doled out evenly to the 19.8 million families the government defines as poor, each household would receive more than $70,000 a year. The source of this dramatic mismatch is a fraud built into how various programs determine welfare eligibility. The government doesn't count any refundable tax credits or benefits that aren't paid in cash as income to the recipients. Some claim this is appropriate because the beneficiaries aren't free to spend non-cash benefits on whatever they like. But that is a specious argument because money is fungible. Receiving Medicaid, for example, frees up cash that would otherwise be spent on health care, allowing the recipients to spend the newly freed cash on other things. Non-cash benefits aren't, in the end, that different from income, except that salaries are taxed while government benefits aren't. And individual welfare programs often don't even count benefits paid in cash as income for the purpose of gauging eligibility. The government's failure to count its largesse as recipients' income allows welfare households to blow past the income level above which a working family no longer qualifies for government help. Take a single parent with two school-aged children who earns $11,000 annually from part-time work. The government considers this household in poverty because its income is below $25,273. But this family would qualify for benefits worth $53,128. It would receive Treasury checks of $3,400 in refundable child tax credits and $4,400 in refundable earned income tax credits. The family would also receive food stamp debit cards worth $9,216 a year, $9,476 in housing subsidies, $877 of government payment for utility bills, $16,033 to fund Medicaid, $3,102 in free meals at school, and $6,624 in temporary assistance for needy families. All this puts the family's income at $64,128, or 254% of the poverty level. A hardworking family earning anything like $64,128 in salary wouldn't be eligible for any of these welfare benefits in four-fifths of the states. Meanwhile, the welfare family would be eligible for another 90 small federal benefits in sundry state and local welfare programs. According to the Congressional Budget Office and other independent researchers, when all the means-tested payments are counted as income, most welfare recipients have incomes that put them in the middle class, and the proportion of poor people in the U.S. falls from more than 10% to less than 1%. This unjust system also penalizes work. Unsurprisingly, the percentage of work-age persons in the bottom 20% of income who in fact work has in the last 50 years fallen from 68% to 36%. The budgetary effects of these inaccurate income calculations are enormous. Look at what government programs cost minus any dedicated revenue they collect and interest on the debt which government is obligated to pay. Payroll taxes fund 87% of Social Security spending, requiring an additional $188 billion, or 4% of unobligated spending. Medicare is 45% funded by payroll taxes and uses $478 billion of unobligated spending, or 11%. Defense spending of $851 billion is 20% of unobligated spending. Means-tested welfare programs absorb $1.4 trillion, 34% of unobligated spending, and the rest of the federal government spends $1.3 trillion, or 30% of unobligated spending. If the government simply gave every poor family in America enough money to raise its income above the official poverty level, it would cost only $240 billion. That would reduce the annual deficit by two-thirds. In light of the mounting evidence of rampant benefits fraud, Congress should institute a comprehensive audit of all means-tested programs, but it should start with removing the largest fraud in welfare, the government's gross overstatement of poverty. President Trump should issue an executive order requiring the Census Bureau to count all welfare benefits received from the government as income to the recipients. Then Congress should codify the executive order and require that all means-tested programs use the corrected census income definition to determine eligibility for welfare payments. At a minimum, the resulting debate would inform the public about the bias in how the government measures income and how that bias has promoted welfare benefits that give recipients a standard of living that most middle-income families struggle to enjoy. The debate would force spending advocates to defend a wasteful and unjust system. Welfare reform would not only help the nation begin to deal with its budget problems, but it could be a powerful issue in American politics headed into the 2026 elections for those willing to champion it. And that article was written by Mr. Graham, a former chairman of the Senate Banking Committee and a non-resident senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. The war on poverty failed in Appalachia. McDowell County isn't waiting for government to restore its fortunes. Carolyn Owens was 9 years old when her family became one of the first in America to get food stamps. Excuse me. Her father could no longer work in the coal mines that pocked the mountains here after an injury. He'd wait at the local government office to collect food coupons, part of a program launched by John F. Kennedy in 1961, to help alleviate the shocking poverty he witnessed campaigning across Appalachia. Owens would walk home from school to find peanut butter sandwiches with a sliver of banana waiting for her and her 10 brothers and sisters. "Those sandwiches were like ice cream for us," said Owens, now 73. In the decades since, the federal government has poured more than $3.6 billion into trying to ease the hardship in McDowell County, according to the Economic Innovation Group. That doesn't include the roughly $13 billion more in Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid payments. It hasn't worked. Here in the heart of America's war on poverty, some two-thirds of households with children still get food stamps, among the nation's highest rates. Non-farm employment has plummeted 78% since 1975, according to data compiled by West Virginia University economist John Deskins, as the coal that once powered this rugged place is now mostly mined with machines, if at all. The county has lost 67% of its residents over those years. The largest drop in West Virginia, its population dwindling from just over 51,000 to roughly 17,000. With little faith left in government to break the cycle of poverty, those who remain say it's up to them to forge a brighter economic path. "We're on our own," said Jason Tart. "Nobody's coming down here to save us." Tart, the grandson of coal miners, is teaching locals, including retired miners and those recovering from opioid addiction, how to farm the forested hillsides. Down the winding two-lane roads that connect communities, a pastor organizes bottled water drives for neighbors whose tap water is undrinkable. A tiny former coal town is trying to transform a shuttered Walmart into a new factory it hopes will jolt the local economy. Their efforts are small in comparison to the government programs that have sought to revive McDowell County and can't make up for the prosperity that slipped away when the coal companies left. But they are spurring hope for a renewal in some places, driven by one of the few constants here, resilience. With limited tax revenue to support local initiatives or infrastructure, a network of nonprofits has sprung up. Many are funded with federal grants and private donations and run by locals, Most have had to figure out how to keep going when government money runs out. There is one thing our people know. If a government program starts, it will surely be cut or end, said Randall Johnson, whose nonprofit, the Council of the Southern Mountains, pushed for the food stamp program here back in the 60s. They strive for self-reliance because they know that mines open and close and government programs end, he added. But they'll always find a way to take care of their children. After Brittany Gibson's father was injured rescuing fellow miners in the deadly Upper Big Branch mine explosion of 2010, her family struggled to get by. Her father was too proud to apply for food stamps when he couldn't work. Her mother sold Gibson stuffed animals and her own jewelry to afford her high school graduation cap and gown. We're forgotten because we've already lost so much. Nobody wants to give us a chance, Gibson said. Gibson, 33, quit her job as a teacher's aide in September and started a one-woman restaurant out of a converted Airstream where she whips up soups, milkshakes, and baked potatoes loaded with bacon. I tell myself, just hang in there, Gibson said. It's what I've told myself my whole life. There's got to be a rainbow somewhere. Changing fortunes. Once among the nation's top coal-producing regions, McDowell County saw its fortunes turn beginning in the 1950s as automated machines meant fewer miners and competing energy sources meant less coal. Things nosedived in the mid-1980s when U.S. Steel shut down its mining operations here virtually overnight. And that's it for today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Ken, your volunteer reader here at the Talking Information Center, and I thank you for listening.